Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Wednesday, June 17th, 2026, and you are joining us for our Blockchain and Digital Assets edition.
Our central thesis today is that the traditional boundary between decentralized finance and artificial intelligence has effectively dissolved. We are moving away from a period of isolated technological silos toward a unified, automated computational layer.
So we are no longer just watching two separate revolutions happen at once.
It is a structural integration.
Let's start by examining the mechanics behind the great AI crypto convergence. 3 million nodes. That is the scale of the network Grass is currently leveraging just to scrape enough real-world data to feed the next generation of models.
It is more than just a trend, Maya. We're seeing the foundational architecture of the internet split into two layers: the intelligence layer, which is becoming increasingly autonomous, and the settlement layer, which provides the decentralized backend for that intelligence to actually transact.
So basically, we are moving from a world where you pay OpenAI a monthly subscription to a world where your digital butler pays a micro fraction of a cent to a decentralized inference provider, and neither of you even realizes a transaction happened.
Two things stand out. The economic model is shifting from centralized subscriptions to API-driven usage. And as Unchained pointed out, this is actually creating a structural financial crisis for Frontier Labs because those subscriptions are currently about 40 times more subsidized than the actual cost of the API calls.
That sounds like a recipe for a massive bankruptcy wave for the AI giants we currently worship.
It might, but the pivot is already happening toward decentralized infrastructure. If you look at the NEAR protocol, Ilya Polysukhin argues that blockchain is the only way to solve the liquidity layer problem in AI training. He describes a vision where the blockchain acts as the root of trust for an agent economy, where AI agents are not just chatbots, but economic actors that use tokens like NEAR to pay for services, settle trades, and even hire subagents.
I love the idea of an agent economy, but I have a hard time believing a bunch of autonomous scripts are going to be polite enough to play by the rules without a massive, centralized regulator stepping in to tell them no.
That's where the crypto-native security primitives come in. We are seeing a shift from reactive human-led policing to proactive cryptographic guardrails. Wyatt Benno from ICME Labs is working on frameworks like Jolt Atlas, which uses zero-liability machine learning, or ZKML, to provide a triple layer of privacy, protecting the user's input, the model's weights, and the architecture itself.
So instead of a human moderator looking at your prompts and deciding if they are offensive, we have math-based walls that simply make it impossible for the agent to violate its policy.
We can trace that further. It moves security from a login audit model, where you find out you were robbed 3 days after the fact, to a machine speed verification. Using technologies like ZKSMT, you can convert natural language instructions into formal mathematical logic. If an agent tries to execute a transaction that violates its programmed intent, the ZK proof simply won't validate, and the transaction fails before it ever hits the chain.
It sounds very much like, trust me, the math says I'm safe.
The math is precisely what makes it trustless. And it's not just about preventing bad behavior, it's about enabling the efficiency of the agentic swarm. Jake Bruckman has noted that while people once thought training AI on consumer hardware was impossible, new algorithms allow swarms of commodity GPUs, like the ones in your gaming PC, to bypass the massive capital expenditures of traditional data centers. He even suggests a merge mining model, where the same matrix multiplications used for AI inference are used to mine cryptocurrency, essentially using the token's value to subsidize the cost of the computation.
Your GPU isn't just running cyberpunk, it's actively subsidizing its own electricity bill by performing intelligence tasks for the network. That's a very convincing way to get people to buy more hardware.
It's also driving an incredible surge in demand. We are seeing what the Blockspace podcast calls the Jevons paradox in the AI sector. Even though the cost of tokens has plummeted by 95% since March 2023, the total volume of usage hasn't shrunk, it has exploded. We went from 2.25 trillion tokens in June 2025 to over 45 trillion tokens in June 2026. The cheaper the intelligence becomes, the more we use it, which actually sustains the investment boom.
It's the more is more principle. But does this actually work for the end user, or are we just building a highly complex playground for developers?
The goal is chain abstraction, where the complexity disappears. Polysukhin's vision for NEAR is that the user interacts with a seamless interface, while the blockchain handles the heavy lifting of identity, payments, and settlement in the background. We are moving toward a barbell user experience, as the roll-up suggests. On one end, you have highly technical traders using traditional interfaces, and on the other, you have autonomous agents executing complex multi-step strategies like hedging compute costs via H100 perpetuals without any human intervention.
It's a bit unnerving to think that the next big Wall Street hedge fund might just be a collection of well-optimized Python scripts running on a decentralized network of MacBooks.
But that's the competitive advantage. Decentralized networks can tap into trace data, the infinite self-generated records of how these agents interact with the world. Unlike the static datasets used by Anthropic or OpenAI, which are running out, the trace data produced by an active agent economy is an inexhaustible supply for model improvement. If you control the harness or the interface where this data is collected, you control the future of training.
It sounds like a massive arms race between centralized frontier models and these decentralized, specialized swarms.
And the security stakes are rising. We've already seen how advanced models like Claude can be used to find critical bugs in complex ZK arithmetic, like the recent issue found in Zcash's Orchard pool. The asymmetry is real. Attackers can use high IQ, automated agents to find vulnerabilities that human auditors miss. This is why we're seeing the rise of adversarial AI, like the Sylvia engine being developed by ProCap, which uses a newsroom of specialized agents to debate theses and fact-check each other to eliminate hallucinations.
The solution to AI hallucinations is more AI. We are essentially building a digital ecosystem of infinite lawyers and auditors to keep the primary bots in line.
It is a self-correcting loop. Whether it is through formal verification of code or using model context protocol servers to anchor LLM responses in audited SEC filings, the objective is to move from probabilistic guesses to deterministic verifiable truth. The infrastructure for this, the payment rails, the shared memory, the privacy layers, is being built on the very blockchain networks that these agents will eventually inhabit.
It's an incredibly dense web of math, money, and machine learning.
It's the convergence of the two most transformative technologies of our era.
Investors should be looking closely at the companies providing the Computazield hardware and the ZK guardrail protocols. Watch for the first major instance of a self-executing corporate merger, where the agents involved negotiate and settle the entire deal without a single human lawyer in the room. But if these agents can manage their own complex financial strategies, what happens when they start applying that same logic to the physical assets we inhabit? We are currently witnessing a massive tug-of-war between two versions of the future. On one side, you have the traditional financial architecture, heavy, slow, and deeply tethered to legacy settlement layers. On the other, you have this aggressive push toward tokenizing the real world, where every piece of the economy, from a gallon of oil to a slice of SpaceX, is being wrapped in code. So, Alex, looking at the sheer momentum of these real-world assets, or RWAs, which side are you betting on?
I'm betting on the frictionless side, Maya. We're seeing a fundamental shift where blockchain's value proposition is moving away from purely speculative tokens toward what some analysts call the securitization of everything. The idea is that tools like Figure's AI Adapter can ingest diverse, non-blockchain loan data to create liquid, on-chain marketplaces for assets that were previously far too illiquid to trade easily.
Securitization of everything. That sounds like a very polite way of saying we're turning every single debt obligation into a digital casino chip.
It's less about gambling and more about removing the paperwork friction of global access. Think of it as the ETF model, but for everything. Blockchain can replicate that massive success by allowing any liquid asset to be instantly accessible within a user's existing digital wallet, without needing a new onboarding process or a mountain of KYC documents for every single trade.
Okay, but let's look at the actual stuff being moved. We aren't just talking about tokenized US treasuries or gold in Singapore. We are seeing people trading pre-IPO shares of companies like SpaceX and Anthropic on decentralized platforms. Is this actually a functional market or just high-stakes internet speculation?
It's becoming a highly functional liquidity layer. Look at Hyperliquid. Coinmetrics' State of the Network reports that its architecture is transforming from a crypto-native exchange into a global liquidity layer for all asset classes, evidenced by $4 billion in open interest, specifically from builder-deployed perpetual markets like equities and commodities. They are even trading things like oil and the NASDAQ 100 through the HIP-3 protocol.
And the volume is actually there.
It is.
In fact, the platform provides a unique arbitrage opportunity because nearly 60% of oil and 50% of S&P 500 perpetual volume occurs outside of U.S. market hours. This allows traders to react to geopolitical events in real time, regardless of whether the New York Stock Exchange is open.
But there's a catch with these pre-IPO plays, right? I see the SpaceX numbers. People are trading these contracts at a massive premium, like $177 per share when the expected IPO price is closer to $135. At some point, the alpha disappears.
You're right, the edge is time-sensitive. As David Canellas has noted, the competitive advantage for retail investors using crypto rails to access these stocks decreases as prices normalize. Once the market stabilizes near the initial list price, that easy profit evaporates. You really have to enter months in advance to capture that spread.
So it's a game of timing. But what about the underlying tech? Is this just a bunch of fragmented apps, or is there a real structure forming?
There's a very specific structure emerging. According to Tokenized, we're seeing a tripartite ecosystem for RWAs. You have specialized asset suppliers like Figure providing the data, liquidity-enabling platforms like Morpho handling the plumbing, and embedded finance distributors like Deal delivering the final product directly to end users. It's a new integrated financial stack.
It sounds like a massive reorganization of the middleman.
Even the way liquidity is bootstrapped is changing. The rollup suggests that unlike traditional AMMs that only solve for price discovery, predictive allocation allows capital allocators to use prediction market-style incentives to bootstrap liquidity in specific markets before demand even arrives. They can capture asymmetric rewards if they correctly forecast future volatility.
It's still worth a reality check, though. If I buy a SpaceX token on a decentralized exchange, I don't actually own a piece of the rocket. I just have a contract that pays out based on a price.
The pattern is clear. The breakdown suggests investors should reframe these on-chain pre-IPO products as purely cash-settled perpetuals for price exposure rather than claims to underlying equity. The structural ability to secure actual shares through crypto-native intermediaries simply doesn't exist yet.
So we have Ethereum acting as the slow, boring finance infrastructure for things like private credit, while high-throughput chains like Solana and Hyperliquid are carving out the niche for high-frequency, fast finance.
That's a great way to frame it. And as Hyperliquid's volume grows, the rollup notes that its derivatives market could become the canonical price for private assets, potentially rendering traditional investment banker-led IPO pricing much less relevant.
Institutional investors need to decide if they are going to build on these high-speed rails or wait for the regulatory dust to settle on whether these instruments are securities or commodities. Watch the spread between Hyperliquid's SpaceX derivatives and the actual IPO price when Anthropic or OpenAI eventually hit the market. If that gap stays wide, the canonical price thesis is still just a dream. But if we can tokenize the entire economy, it leads us to a much more physical tension. How do we manage the massive, surging demand for electricity as these new digital and industrial frontiers collide? We all thought the digital gold rush was going to be about who had the cleverest code or the fastest GPUs, but it turns out the real battlefield is just a very expensive pile of copper wire and transformers.
The bottleneck has shifted from capital scarcity to geospatial scarcity, where the limiting factor for the AI revolution is no longer how much money you can raise, but whether you can actually plug your hardware into a functioning grid.
It's the ultimate way to ruin a tech hype cycle. First, you run out of chips, then you run out of programmers, and then you realize you can't even turn the lights on in your own building.
We're seeing a fundamental strategic pivot in the industry from following the network to following the power, because the era of prioritizing low-latency connections in places like Northern Virginia's data center alley is hitting a wall of electrical exhaustion.
Instead of building where the internet is fastest, we're building wherever the electricity is available.
Which is why we're seeing massive interest in brownfield sites, repurposing old coal plants or aluminum smelters like TerraWulf's Lake Mariner site, because these locations already have the transmission infrastructure to bypass the 7-year wait for new utility connections.
That sounds suspiciously like we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, only the deck chairs are made of decommissioned turbines.
It's more of a tactical land grab. In the Texas market, the ERCOT interconnection queue for large loads ballooned to 410 gigawatts in early 2026, largely driven by data center requests, but there's a massive amount of phantom load in those numbers. ERCOT anticipates only about 49% of that claimed demand will actually materialize.
A little less ghost demand and a little more actual power would be great for everyone's electric bill.
The pressure is mounting on both sides of the meter. On one side, the Trump administration's ratepayer protection pledge is forcing hyperscalers to fund their own grid upgrades to prevent political backlash. On the other side, regulators are moving from voluntary to mandatory curtailment models for large loads.
The big tech companies are being told they can have the power, but only if they pay for the new roads and don't complain when the grid asks them to turn it off during a heat wave.
It's a telling detail. To mitigate that revenue risk, new operators are increasingly using behind-the-meter strategies like gas turbine backups to create a decoupled energy model that allows for operational continuity when the grid can't provide power. It's creating a new layer of infrastructure that functions independently of the public utility.
It's basically the digital equivalent of building a private fortress with its own well and solar panels because you don't trust the city's water supply.
And the tension is localizing. We're seeing a social license to operate crisis. While the early crypto mining era faced noise complaints, the AI era is facing intense scrutiny over water usage and thermal pollution. This has already resulted in 34 gigawatts of the data center pipeline being stranded due to community pushback and regulatory moratoriums.
I love how the opposition is getting more sophisticated, using AI-generated synthetic country music to protest the very AI infrastructure they're worried about.
It's a horseshoe effect of political resistance, spanning from rural anti-surveillance groups to urban activists. In places like Tennessee, Georgia, and Missouri, the resistance is decoupled from partisan lines. It's driven by highly educated, affluent NIMBY populations.
Which brings us to the ultimate escape hatch, just move the servers into orbit.
That's the SpaceX play. Elon Musk has suggested that moving data centers into space could bypass terrestrial regulatory hurdles and use solar energy that is 5 or even 5 times more efficient than on Earth. The Starlink network is essentially becoming the anchor for a data center in space thesis, leveraging the lack of NIMBY opposition and the absence of a day-night cycle.
A space-based, decentralized edge compute model sounds great, until you realize we're just trading terrestrial grid failures for orbital debris.
But for the players on the ground, the opportunity is massive. We're seeing a structural shift where Bitcoin mining capacity is being repurposed for high-performance computing. This could actually trigger a medium-term appreciation in Bitcoin mining economics because the influx of AI demand is creating a supply-side scarcity of available power.
It's a fascinating, if slightly terrifying, transition from being a digital currency miner to becoming a specialized utility provider for the AI giants.
The industry is stratifying into distinct asset classes, from the neoclouds providing GPU leasing to the massive proprietary builds by Google and Meta. The real winners are those who hold the call option of long-term power agreements.
Texas-based regulators need to finalize the Senate Bill 6 reforms before the cost of indirect infrastructure upgrades makes these projects unbankable. Keep a close eye on the expansion of the PJM interconnection in the eastern U.S., because if they can't secure that $15 billion in new baseload power, the entire AI expansion plan hits a literal dead end. But if we can solve the physical power problem, does the real struggle begin with how we integrate all this decentralized wealth into the traditional banking system? The plan is to essentially replace the entire back office of Wall Street with a single piece of code, and we're all just supposed to nod along.
If you're looking at the thesis for the on-chain economy, it's less about replacing people and more about removing the friction of legal and middle office layers. Alex Cutler argues that platforms like Aerodrome are aiming to become the NYSE of the on-chain economy by unifying the EVM ecosystem, essentially turning on-chain infrastructure into a more efficient settlement layer than a traditional brokerage like Schwab.
Right, because nothing says efficient like moving the entire global financial architecture onto a system where a single typo in a smart contract can vanish $1 billion.
That's why the shift is moving from speculative ship coins to assets with verifiable utility and predictable value accrual. We're seeing a massive influx of institutional capital into highly liquid programmatic investments, like Coinbase Ventures' recent moves into Aerodrome. It's no longer about the hype, it's about applying traditional revenue and cost analysis to tokens.
So we've graduated from moon math to boring accounting. Progress?
It's actually much more structural than that. The regulatory landscape is undergoing a massive pivot. CFTC Chairman Mike Selig has highlighted a shift from regulation by enforcement toward a tailor-and-fit model designed to onshore crypto and derivative trading to the U.S. The goal is to prevent regulatory flight, where traders use VPNs to hit offshore platforms. By classifying perpetuals as futures rather than swaps, the CFTC is effectively opening a highway for mass retail distribution.
I love that. Don't worry, we've made the unregulated Wild West slightly more regulated and much more American.
The mechanism is actually quite clever. As noted in the Bloomberg surveillance discussions, the CFTC is exploring ways for self-custodial wallet providers to offer access without the massive burden of registering as brokers. This could create a massive funnel strategy. Look at Hyperliquid. They can partner with a U.S.-regulated futures commission merchant to allow U.S. institutions access to their deep liquidity without the fragmentation of a separate, isolated U.S. entity.
But what about the actual money? Is it just us trading digital tokens of tokens?
It's moving into the plumbing of global payments. We're seeing a fundamental shift where stablecoins are transitioning from trading tools to functional layers for programmable money. As Raghulan Pathy predicts, stablecoins could handle 30% to 50% of global transaction volume over the next 2 decades. And the advantage is structural. As the bell curve analysis points out, the singleness of money in stablecoins provides interoperable, fungible liquidity, whereas tokenized deposits remain fragmented and tied to the specific creditworthiness of individual banks.
So a stablecoin is a universal language and a bank deposit is just a local dialect.
There's a signal here that interoperability is driving a massive application layer. We're seeing companies like Figure evolve from specialized lenders into high-efficiency M&A platforms by using blockchain to strip out middle and back office costs. The real value is moving from the base layers to the apps that use these rails.
I'm still waiting for the part where this doesn't just create new, more complex ways to crash.
That's the conviction gap we're seeing. According to Empire, the lack of institutional-grade data, where different platforms report protocol revenues with discrepancies as high as 30%, is what prevents high-conviction stances. To reach the next phase, we need standardized disclosure layers to prevent artificial volume inflation. We need the system of record to be as transparent as the liquidity itself.
Institutional investors are going to start demanding much tighter audit trails before they commit to these new rails.
Keep an eye on the USDC EURC volumes in the next year. If decentralized exchanges start outpacing centralized players in non-crypto asset classes, the integration is officially irreversible.
But even with all this plumbing being rebuilt, we still have to contend with the unpredictable winds of the broader economy.
I've been staring at the liquidity flows for the last week, and we are seeing a massive structural migration of capital that looks a lot like a vacuum cleaner sucking the life out of crypto.
That sounds incredibly dramatic even for you. Are we talking about a market correction, or are you actually predicting a total disappearance of the blockchain?
I'm talking about a liquidity suck driven by the macro environment. Between the massive $20 billion debt issuance from NVIDIA and the sheer volume of capital flooding into AI hyperscalers and SpaceX pre-IPO opportunities, we're seeing a direct siphon from Bitcoin ETFs into high-hype equity. We saw $1.4 billion in outflows from Bitcoin ETFs in just the first 5 days of June alone.
The risk-off sentiment isn't just about Bitcoin's price dropping, it's about the shiny new AI toys stealing all the players from the table.
Something to flag here, it's getting more complicated because the holders themselves are the problem. The breakdown reported that BlackRock's IBIT is currently $13 to $16 billion underwater because its massive scale is paired with a shareholder base that historically accumulates during rallies, leaving them with an average entry price of roughly $79,500.
Wait, so the very people who are supposed to provide the floor are actually the ones most likely to trigger a mass exit if the price dips further?
Stepping back, it's what they call the ETF wrapper phenomenon, where the fund's performance is driven more by the behavioral profile of its specific shareholders than by the underlying asset. If Bitcoin stays below that 200-week moving average, we face a massive capitulation risk from these ETF holders.
It sounds like a house of cards, especially when you look at the corporate treasuries. Is MicroStrategy just as vulnerable?
It's a different kind of tension. 0x research suggests a MicroStrategy trilemma where the company is balancing Bitcoin stability, its own stock price, and servicing debt holders. They might even intentionally sacrifice equity value to satisfy creditors.
Saylor is essentially playing a high-stakes game of musical chairs with his own balance sheet.
It's a strategic hedge, though. Bell Curve noted that MicroStrategy's recent microsales, like that 32 BTC dip before the 1,550 BTC buy, might serve as market inoculation, building immunity to much larger, more violent sales in the future.
I'm not sure I'd call a heart attack inoculation, Alex.
True, but with May's CPI at 4.2% and the probability of a Fed rate hike in 2026 jumping from 15% to 51%, the macro volatility is only going to intensify.
ETF investors need to start taking profits at the peaks rather than waiting for the next bull run. Keep a close eye on the May PPI data in July to see if that inflation trend breaks. As we wrap up this week, the thread connecting everything from the massive expansion of the Grass network to the staggering growth in token demand is the collapse of the distinction between computational intelligence and financial settlement. We aren't just seeing a new asset class, we are witnessing the emergence of a unified, automated economic layer where the boundary between a neural network's inference and a blockchain's transaction is effectively evaporating.
The data tells a story. The real operational shift here isn't for the retail speculator, but for the institutional treasury manager. As we move from subscription-based software to decentralized, usage-based infrastructure, the calculus for firms like BlackRock or MicroStrategy changes fundamentally. They are no longer just managing exposure to price volatility. They are managing exposure to a global autonomous settlement layer where the speed of capital is now directly tethered to the availability of gigawatts. When the cost of an API call or smart contract execution is dictated by the stability of the ERCOT grid or the availability of stranded power, the risk-free rate suddenly includes a heavy dose of energy latency physics.
It turns the entire concept of liquidity on its head. We are moving away from a world of human-intermediated markets toward a landscape where the primary liquidity providers might be self-optimizing, agentic swarms operating 24/7, indifferent to U.S. trading hours or traditional settlement cycles.
And to see if this thesis holds, we need to look closely at the next round of Bitcoin ETF flow data alongside the quarterly energy interconnection reports from the major U.S. grids. If we see significant capital flight from BTC into high-growth AI equities, it will confirm that the market currently views the convergence as a competition for resources rather than a synergistic integration. If the inflows stabilize even as power demand surges, it means the market has finally accepted that the new digital economy requires its own dedicated energy-dense foundation.
Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next Wednesday.